From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on an August evening, 1996, on Norton Street in the city of Rochester. One of the oldest baseball parks in the country was hosting its final regular season home game. The Rochester Red Wings moved into that stadium in 1929, a stadium that would become known as Silver Stadium. After 68 seasons, the Wings were preparing to move into their new home, the one that I'm looking at empty right now, across from us in WXXI in High Falls. And that night in 1996 was a time to reflect and celebrate in a city that has loved and supported minor league baseball. Sunday's Father's Day. To state the obvious, baseball is a sport for everyone, young and old, sons, daughters, dads, moms. But there is often something special about Father's Day in ballparks across the United States. This year, of course, there is no professional baseball to go see. The pandemic has taken the games away from us. It doesn't have to be that way all summer. Other professional sports leagues around the world are figuring out schedules and safety protocols. But for weeks, Major League Baseball has dithered with disputes about who gets paid what, how many games, how to divide up the revenue pie. You think Americans who've been out of work want to hear that? For millions of people who have weathered the pandemic at home and looked forward to the respite of sports, it's becoming a kind of national shame. Well, we'll discuss the impact a baseball field sitting empty this hour. And we're also going to turn our attention to Rochester's history. I can speak for myself and say we all want the Red Wings back on the field as soon as we can. I don't know of any proposals that could get that done anytime soon, but we're hoping. And WXXI is honoring the history locally by airing the final home regular season game at Silver Stadium. That's going to be on Sunday, Father's Day. It's a salute to baseball, a salute to Rochester and history. The program is called Last at Bat, and you can see it 1 p.m. on Sunday. Joining us to discuss this hour are a couple of people who were there leading that broadcast. Hello, Pete Weber. Nice to have you with us.
Very nice to be with you. Thank you so much for including me.
And Kurt Smith, an author, media host, columnist, and a historian who has forgotten more about baseball than most people will ever know. Welcome back to the program, Kurt.
Well, I appreciate it. Great to be with you.
I could probably say the same about Scott Pitoniak, a longtime Rochester sports columnist and author of countless books, back with us. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, good. I'd be better if I was looking at a field with baseball being played instead of a big old empty park. I know Dan and the crew want that too, but they're trying to do everything. Everybody's trying to do the best they can. And Naomi Silver is the president and CEO of the Rochester Red Wings. And we all want you back, Naomi, but I know that it's not an easy time for anybody in professional sports. How are you?
Hi there, Evan. And guys, great to hear your voices. We are as anxious as anybody can possibly be about getting baseball back. That empty stadium just doesn't sit well with us. So it'll be fun when we can get back to it. Just don't know when that will be.
Well, we're going to dive into the history in just a moment. But let me just hit that point with you first, Naomi. You know, we are learning so much more now as we head towards the end of June than we knew 3 months ago when the pandemic was so new. It does not mean that infection doesn't transfer and spread outdoors, but the transmission rate outdoors, we now know, is so much less than it is indoors. We know more about how it does and does not transmit, or the likelihood of transmission. And it, you know, maybe I'm naive. It feels to me that sitting here in June, I know you can't have a full season, but with the knowledge we have, the safety protocols, now the better testing supply, are you surprised that we don't have games at least at the major league level, if not at all levels right now, Naomi?
Well, I think we've all learned what social distancing could mean in our stadiums, and, you know, we've all played with seating charts that would allow the proper distancing. Yeah, we're a little disappointed. Certainly, we're at the mercy of Major League Baseball's decision, because if they're not going to play in the big leagues, it's very highly unlikely that the major league teams will send their affiliate minor league clubs to their home cities. So we sit and wait, but we believe that we could be prepared at this point, given all the time that we've had to think it out, imagine it, reimagine how we go about it.
Yeah, I'm going to be there with my boy on Sunday for an awesome event. Father's Day, a little meal, a little ambiance, and I know there are things that are going to be happening there. But Naomi, let's say you got an unexpected notice this afternoon or this weekend or Monday, and you were told, "Hey, if we can figure this out, we're going to do this." How fast do you think teams like the Red Wings and organizations could make the transition to getting ready for at least a truncated season?
I believe that we could do it in a couple of weeks. You know, the biggest piece of it, I think, would be hiring all of our part-time staff, which unfortunately did not get to come to work this year. That's a few hundred people. Of course, it would be a smaller staff if we're serving fewer fans, but nonetheless, we have to bring people in and train them and get ready to go. But, you know, our front office staff is more than ready to go.
Yeah, I hear that. So let me ask the other guest, Scott Pitoniak. Is there anything sort of more crass than millions of Americans who've been out of work, maybe not having a paycheck, struggling, trying to figure out the future, who just want to watch baseball and watch billionaires and millionaires argue over how to divide a revenue pie?
I don't know of anything more crass. It's disgusting, Evan, when you look at this on so many levels. And this is worse than it was, you know, back in 1994 when they had the audacity to cancel a World Series, which an event that was held during two world wars, the Great Depression, and, oh, yeah, by the way, another pandemic, the pandemic of 1918. I just can't believe how tone deaf both the owners and the players are at this time when, you know, America really needs anything that would make us feel a little bit more normal, you know, a little bit a return to normalcy, whatever that's going to be, the new normalcy. But and I blame the leadership of baseball more than anybody else. I think Rob Manfred, and I hate to do this, I mean, guy from my hometown of Rome, New York, but I think he's totally blown this. And, you know, I just really, really worry about the long-term ramifications here, you know, about the game of baseball and what this is going to do to it.
Yeah, Scott, just to follow that point, the long-term impacts, I was talking recently to a health teacher who's also a football coach in a rural school district here. And he said, you know, having moved to this district only recently, he couldn't believe how few kids in this school district, and we're talking less than an hour from Rochester, played baseball or even knew the rules. He said playing a kickball game, which is essentially baseball rules, he said most of the kids didn't even know the rules. I am concerned. Are you is that too sort of big a leap to make that connection?
No. It's been a long time concern here, again, about, you know, growing the game, introducing the game to another generation. And this goes back also to, I blame the leadership of Major League Baseball for its terrible, abusive treatment of the minor leagues. And, you know, like the Rochester Red Wings and the Batavia Muck Dogs and on. And because I look at the minor leagues as a great entry point for young people to be to be introduced to the game. And, you know, there's so many stories of parents taking young kids to the game, having such a great experience at a minor league game that they make a fan for life. Baseball needs to understand that. They don't. They're doing the short money grab. Rob Manfred, already before this all happened with the pandemic, was talking about contracting 42 minor league teams. Well, now the pandemic's going to do even more than that for him. But it's a short-term money grab with long-term deleterious effects. Mm.
Kurt Smith, what do you think?
Well, it's I would second everything that that Scott has to say. The term leadership is actually oxymoronic in baseball. It's also moronic because the lack of interest among youth in baseball is absolutely correct. I teach English at the University of Rochester, and among the courses I teach is public speaking. And I've had a number of the very few students who are interested in baseball give speeches of their own volition in the last several years, talking about how few people in their age group, 18 to 22, actually are interested in the sport, let alone enamored. 10 years ago, I could get a debate being a Boston Red Sox fan, and here we are in upstate New York, the home of the Hall of Fame, and the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry, the most rabid in baseball, or at least it has been. And I could get a debate started as a Red Sox fan, picking a well-intentioned fight, if you would, with Yankee fans. Today I can't because no one cares. or almost no one, let us say. Rob Manfred is an absolute disgrace. He's got all the stage presence of Barney Fife by way of Elmer Fudd. He's one of the worst public speakers that I've ever seen, and he's a catastrophe as baseball's commissioner. He's the worst commissioner since William Eckert. He should be replaced as far as I'm concerned, because he began his stewardship, if you can call it that, 5 years ago. You remember his first recommendation? That in tie games, the solution to a tie game to limit the length of an overly long game would be to put a runner on second base at the beginning of an extra inning game. This is a man who doesn't understand the soul of the game. Like the rest of baseball's major league hierarchy, he reminds me of the Oscar Wilde line, "They understand the price of everything and the value of nothing." This whole catastrophe in terms of this calamity, and Scott is right, this is far worse than 1994-95. For one thing, baseball approaches this from a far weaker position in terms of public popularity, is triggered by the fact that the Players Union runs baseball. And Tony Clark, the head of the Public Players Association, has thoroughly intimidated Rob Manfred. Rob Manfred, for 3 to 4 years now, has had three rules already enacted on the books, which would enormously shorten the length of an average game. Number one, you make the pitcher throw the ball within 20 seconds with no runner on base. He could enact that by simply signing his name to it and telling the umpires to do so. Number two, don't let the batter step out of the batter's box without the umpire's approval. And thirdly, call the high strike zone, which would keep a lot of full counts from being called. You would take 20 to 30 minutes off the length of an average game. Manfred said he would not do that because he wanted the union's collaboration. Well, you and I will see the 12th of never before that occurs. So basically, he wouldn't do it because Clark intimidated him. Then, in my view at least, over the last several days, Clark double-crossed him in terms of what Manfred thought, rather naively, if you would, that an agreement had been reached. So here we are. We've passed Mother's Day. We've passed about to pass Father's Day. We will pass the 4th of July. The end of summer will be here before we know it, and baseball is MIA. Merry Christmas.
Oh, boy. Tough. Pete Weber, you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, and I think, and Kurt, number one, I think we have to acknowledge Tony Clark, maybe the best first baseman I ever saw for the old Niagara Falls Rapids. But let's go off from that. And here's the other thing with all of that. This is a time where we are approaching, and I'm very afraid of the younger fans who have really no idea of the allure of this game to so many of us. It's kind of going back to an old story with the Utah Jazz. And I know this is probably the only person who's going to pull this in right now. But there was a player on the Utah Jazz when Frank Layden was coaching them who went up to him and he said, "What's the problem with you? Is it ignorance or is it apathy?" And the player responded, "I don't care." And I'm afraid that's what we're coming up to right now with the younger generation of people coming up. And it probably, Kurt, all goes back to putting World Series games on where they end after midnight.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, listeners, we're talking baseball this hour. It's been a bit of an ominous start to the proceedings. But we're going to try to turn our attention to something a little bit more pleasant. Though I do have to say I think all four of our guests' comments, I think, are well taken here. And there is a real risk here. I mean, my 8-year-old son loves baseball. He loves envisioning a stadium everywhere he goes. And actually, as I watched, I had a chance to preview and review and preview Last at Bat, which is coming your way 1 p.m. on Sunday on Father's Day on WXXI-TV. Kurt Smith, you said something about stadiums that rang true. You said a lot of stadiums have the charm of like a strip mall. you know, or there was some remark like that.
Right.
And you loved Silver Stadium. So before we get to Silver, what are your favorite stadiums that aren't Silver Stadium or aren't Rochester-based? I'd like all of our guests to weigh in, especially because when we think about the loss of this, so
right.
much of this is the atmosphere that kids grow up in. These are like cathedrals for kids. That's why they're in their own backyard. They create in their own mind a stadium, and the wind blowing through the trees is the sound of the fans. What are your favorites, Kurt?
Well, I think that one of the great developments for baseball over the last 30 years has been a resurrection of the Cathedral of the Outdoors that once birthed baseball's early days, the Polo Grounds, the Fenway Park, Crosley Field, Forbes Field. But my favorites are Fenway Park, not simply because I'm a Red Sox fan, but because of the intimacy, and anything can happen and often does. My other favorites are Camden Yards in Baltimore, and PNC in Pittsburgh, but really also a park that I have not seen, and that is AT&T or whatever its current name is in San Francisco. But this is one of the great developments in baseball over the last 20 to 25 to 30 years.
You mean actual character again? Because
I think so,
and
there is an idiosyncrasy to them. Each one is different in its own way. They're not as stunningly different as each park was from another in the early days of baseball. The Polo Grounds, which sadly I'm too young to have ever visited, but I wish I could have, because here you had a park where you could hit a 480-foot out to center field and a 257-foot home run to right field. Now, figure that out, but it did happen. And Ebbets Field, where you had the Dodger Symphony and Gladys Gooding, the quintessential Dodger fan, screaming plaudits at Dodger fans and obscenities at Dodger opponents, and where the Dodgers were the entire hub of that community. There's a certain romance to that. So each one was different then. But at least there's been a U-turn and a coming back to that day after that awful period from the 1960s through the 1990s, where, in fact, each park was a clone, when football was the great beneficiary of all these terrible clones, and when you were in another county in an upper deck, when natural grass was not permitted, and when, as Dick Allen said once, that he wouldn't play on anything or wouldn't like anything on which his horse couldn't eat off of, meaning, of course, grass.
Baseball's not meant to be played on cement. I can attest
True
to
enough.
That. Yeah. Pete, your favorites?
Well, my favorites are a couple of them are Kurt's. Fenway Park, Oriole Park at Camden Yards, another more reflects maybe my fanhood as a youngster, and I've seen games in all three of the St. Louis Cardinals, including the last game they had at Old Sportsman's Park on Mother's Day in 1966. My mother, nice enough to take me to that. Then Busch Stadium 2 and the current Busch Stadium that they have. I've been fortunate enough to be there with the Nashville Predators going in to take on the St. Louis Blues in the playoffs, and lo and behold, the Cardinals were home. Albeit that was a great deal of fun for me. And there's another park that I think is one that maybe is going to get overlooked a little bit here, but Target Field in Minneapolis, I think, is absolutely gorgeous. Mm.
Yeah, great-looking ballpark for sure. Scott Pitoniak, favorites?
Well, first off, I got to say I'm surprised that Pete didn't mention the Rock Pile, since he had worked games there. And, of course, you know, the old War Memorial Stadium in Buffalo, where The Natural was filmed. And by the way, when the producers were looking at a place to film The Natural, they did look at Silver Stadium as well, because they wanted
summer of 83, Scott. I'm sorry on that, but I was just restricting myself to the Major League Baseball ballparks. But yes, the Rock Pile has a dear part in my heart. There's no question.
Yes. I agree with Pete and Kurt with many of the ballparks they've mentioned. And me being a follower of the Yankees since 1961, I still love Fenway Park. I can say that. But my all-time favorite has to be the old Yankee Stadium. I'm talking about the Roman Coliseum of American sports. You know, with the frieze, the facade, the ornate scaffold, scaffold roof that was, you know, all around the stadium. It had a majesty to it. And as Kurt was mentioning about the Polo Grounds, well, there were very, very unusual dimensions there at Yankee Stadium where Yogi Berra could wrap that 296-foot home run around that foul pole in right field, or Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio could hit the ball 460 feet and it would be caught in left center field. So it was, you know, and I think much of this, our love affair with parks has to do with our youth, you know, and my first major league game ever was at the old Yankee Stadium, Bobby Richardson Day, September 18th, 1966. And I fell in love with the place. Mm. It was the, you know, the Wizard of Oz experience of walking in and, you know, the part of the film where it goes from black and white to Technicolor. That was the experience I had walking in there with my father and seeing this massive green expanse and knowing that Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio had played there, and I was about to see Mickey Mantle play there.
Well, I got to say, Scott, you know, I think the old Yankee Stadium, look, I have a bias. I tend to think that if you're a Yankees fan, it's a character flaw. But, you know, we can set that aside for a moment. I do think, having been to a number of the newer parks, I do actually think the new Yankee Stadium is the most sterile and the least interesting of the group. And I don't mean that, you know, to demean any Yankees fans. I just find it the least interesting. But I was looking, for some reason, my son and I were looking up Lou Gehrig videos. Found a video from 1931 where Gehrig and Ruth were both playing in a game, they were playing the Red Sox. I did not realize, Scott, that in the old Yankee, I mean, like the early version of that stadium, you could hit a ball to sort of left center field, and if you hit it 400 feet, it was a home run. If you hit it 420 feet on the exact same line, it may fly over that cutout of stands back into play. It was such a strange little cutout. I'm looking at this video going, how come I didn't know this existed? It was very quirky. I actually loved that about it.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the thing that we love about all these parks, you know, like the Green Monster, having to play the ball off the Green Monster. It could bounce all the way back to the infield, and nobody played it better than Carl Yastrzemski. You know, these quirky things about the geography and the geometry of these ballparks, many of them were shoehorned into city blocks, which is why, you know, you had these strange dimensions with Ebbets Field in particular, where it would be ridiculously short in certain areas and ridiculously long in other areas. And I think that that's part of the charm. And Silver had that, and its dimensions changed along the way during its evolution, too.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons when the Astros' new stadium opened a number of years ago, it wasn't just created to be a place where you could very effectively tunnel sounds of garbage cans banging. There was actually some interesting things in the stadium. And I liked that hill in center field and the flagpole in play. To me, it felt like growing up. It sort of felt like backyard ball. But I understand lawyers don't like it when players can run full speed into poles. And now there's a lawyer in charge of Major League Baseball. Naomi Silver, do you have something to sort of comes to mind when you think of ambiance, of a great place to see a ball game?
You know, I can't help but think of Camden Yards as, you know, probably the first ballpark that was built in that nostalgic yet modernized to meet fan needs that we really tried to model Frontier Field after, as we were affiliates of the Orioles for so long and during that time period. And, you know, it's very special when you can look at a ballpark and feel like it's been here for a long time. It's not, you know, it's not so new and sterile, and it takes a while to break it in. I think from the minute Frontier Field opened, it felt like it was part of the landscape. So, you know, it took a lot of research and design, but it was definitely worth it. It makes all the difference in the world when you walk in. It's the feeling you get from the minute you enter the gates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very special. You know, and I'll just say, you know, you talk about, you know, Major League Baseball, you know, struggling with, you know, with its problems right now. Very true. But fortunately, in the minor leagues, we have we're doing quite well, except for this season. You know, we're drawing more people than we ever have before, and people still, because it's affordable and because we try harder, I guess, people come out in families and friend groups, and it's quite different than it is at the big league level, where it's very rare that you see families who are able to afford the experience. So that's, you know, part of the pride that we have in minor league baseball and our minor league towns.
Yeah, I think it's an important distinction, Naomi. I mean, if you see families at major league games, it's often a sort of once-a-year thing. You plan for it, et cetera. You can make that a regular thing in minor league ballpark cities, and people do in Rochester. And I know Russell in Brighton wanted to add to the conversation. He's on the phone. Go ahead, Russell. Are you there, Russell? He may be listening on the regular terrestrial radio and maybe behind us here. Are you there, Russell? I'll tell you what, Russell. I'm going to put you back on hold because he wanted to add to Kurt Smith's list of older ballparks, and he was talking to our producer, Megan Mack. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to take our only break of the hour. I'll see if I can snag Russell's call, and then I want to talk about what's coming up on Sunday, on Father's Day, at 1 p.m. WXXI-TV. Is bringing you Last at Bat, and it is the final regular season home game from Silver Stadium 1996. You miss baseball? Yeah, you miss sort of the feeling that summer is here, the ball games are here. We're trying to fill that for you a little bit with WXXI and that final broadcast, and Pete and Kurt, of course, were part of that, leading the way. So there's some memories, a talk of the present and the future, and we'll get right back to it after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking to a guy who has built his career helping people understand how to move from reading to action. It's one thing to read books about racial equity. It's another to actually get involved with doing work. The New York Times bestseller list is all about books on advantage, privilege, and more. What does action look like? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A couple of listener comments. Philip says, Evan, don't dismiss the health of the players when talking about these negotiations. It's not just about money. Why should the players have to put their health at risk and not be properly compensated? Philip, it's a fair question. I hope I never implied that I don't think the players should be thinking about their health or all of that entails. I think every league around the world is doing that. And you see football leagues, they call it soccer here, back in Europe. You've got the NBA has got its own bubbled plan to begin games at the end of July, and I know there's some consternation that some of the players have, but they're working on that, and they have a remarkably detailed schedule for what they're going to do on a daily basis. So absolutely, we should think about that. I'm sure the players are thinking about that, and I'm sure there are some who might decide it's not worth it or the sacrifice would be too much. But I think there's a lot of people who want to play, and certainly the fans would like to see them as long as you know, everyone from the epidemiologist to the team staffs can feel as reasonably good about it as possible. And baseball is unique in its how obstreperous it has been about getting this going. And that is a shame. I do have Russell back on the phone. Go ahead, Russell.
Oh, good. I always enjoy people talking about baseball.
Well, good.
To me, the best ballpark ever in the major leagues was Ebbets Field. This little 32,000-seat stadium was the most intimate stadium around. And the Dodger fans, you couldn't compare them with anybody. And with Gladys Gooding playing the organ all the time, and with that crazy right field wall that was along Bedford Avenue, which, of course, is why it was built there, because the trolley car ran there, naming the Dodgers the Trolley Dodgers when right field was open. But also I'd like to say that some of the best rivalries were between the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers in the same city. So I know the Red Sox and the Yankees, that's the American League. That was a more sophisticated league. We were really down to what baseball was all about. So that, to me, I had to get that. And, of course, being a little bit older than many of the people, baseball was started in the late 1800s. It's a game to go out on a Sunday or an afternoon, a sunny day, by horse-drawn vehicles and enjoy the game and the weather. There's no hurry. And if a game goes to 12 innings, that was a great bonus, not anything that we were upset about.
Well, I take that point, Russell. I went to a Cleveland Indians-Minnesota Twins game that went 18 innings one day, and I was delighted. I was a teenager, and that was just fine by me. I think Kurt's point, though, is looking at just the reality of what makes the game appealing to televised and radio audiences, and you go past 3 hours, and it's tough. And so I think that some of these proposals have been about trying to get more consistent viewership, attendance, et cetera. Kurt, you want to add to some of his characterizations of Ebbets and the history?
Yes. I mean, I agree with them all. I wish I had been born earlier so that I could have gone to Ebbets Field. I'm sure I would have been a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. Their lineal descendant is the Boston Red Sox. I think that there probably have been more books written about the Brooklyn Dodgers than perhaps any other team. They had the great broadcaster in Red Barber, who really became the voice of the entire borough. We were talking about the idiosyncrasy, the different lengths, and that was certainly true of Ebbets Field. There was also the cry of wait till next year. And there's nothing that creates interest like longing. And the Dodgers had lost so many times, and almost always to the hated New York Yankees, that each season when they went to the World Series, and I think that they had lost to the Yankees six times, straight times, if memory serves, before finally next year arrived in 1955. And then, of course, Walter O'Malley, their vile owner, who is without doubt the most hated man in Brooklyn and probably in the history of professional sport and deserves to be, moved that team 2 years after they had won the World Series to Los Angeles, not because he wasn't making money. He was making more money, as he told Congress 2 years after moving the team, than any other owner in baseball, but that he wasn't making enough. Does that ring sound familiar?
Oh, man.
That's exactly baseball today, at least in the major leagues. If I could, though, a very brief point in terms of what Naomi was noting quite eloquently regarding the minor leagues. Sports Illustrated had an issue a couple weeks ago about the minor leagues and the shameful way that the major leagues are treating them. In the minors last year, attendance across the minors topped 41.5 million people, an increase of more than 1 million fans from the season before, and the 15th straight year above 40 million. In good times and bad, the minors perform exemplary. And I think that it is shameful, as I said, that the major leagues treat them in the way that they do, trying to extract an affiliation with 42 teams is not a way to treat the way that baseball reaches small town America. Baseball's roots are rural; they're small town. And Scott mentioned The Natural, which to me is the greatest baseball movie ever made, because it captures the essence, the heart and soul of America. Roy Hobbs grew up where? In rural America. Baseball doesn't understand this. Sometimes if I wish we could take Rob Manfred, plunk him down in the heart of America, and maybe he'd begin to understand what this game is all about.
Well, back to the phones we go. Ted in Pittsford. Go ahead, Ted.
Hi, Evan. Just a couple quick things. Naomi, I may or may not remember this, but my daughter and I were waiting in line at the Orlando airport, and I had my plates hat on, and we had a nice little conversation.
And, I sure do.
You remember that. And I told you that I was going to be there on opening day, and as soon as baseball opens up again at Frontier, you can bet that I will have my season tickets. They're already paid for. And I will be there, and I just miss baseball so terribly in Rochester, and so I'm just hoping that we can get it back.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And to Scott, probably the best book I've ever written and read in sports was Silver Seasons. I read that. I look at that book all the time. I use it as reference to remember some of the things, because I go back to 1960. And is there ever going to be a time when you and your partner will be able to update it, bring it up to speed? Because if you did, I'd buy the whole book all over again.
Well, Jim, it's a great read. Well, thank you, first off, so much for those wonderful comments. And we did do an update. I want to say about Jim Mandolaro, my co-author, and I did an update. And we added about 150 pages. It brought it up to, you know, into the Twins era. And we changed the title a little bit from Silver Seasons to Silver Seasons and a New Frontier, the story of the Rochester Red Wings.
I've got that one.
Yeah, we would love to update it, but you know, that's always up to publishers, as Kurt Smith can certainly tell you, that doesn't always work out well. So
Scott Pitoniak, I've got to say Silver Seasons and a New Frontier is the best title you could have. I mean, that is a dream title for a book. There's no way you came up with that, Scott Pitoniak.
Yes, I did. No, I mean, it was
very poetic.
I thought, you know,
it is perfect, and it is still available now, right, Scott?
Yes, it is.
I will shill for any author who comes on this program, and we have several. Kurt and Scott's books make great Father's Day gifts because we can't go to baseball games right now. Though, as Naomi Silver, who's with us, the president and CEO of the Rochester Red Wings, one of our guests this hour, they want to be there. They're going to be there when they can be there, yeah. Not sooner. And I'm sort of not doing PR for it. I'm being honest. Everyone takes the pandemic seriously, but everybody in professional sports wants a chance to be there for the public. So tough times. Let me squeeze in a few more listener comments, and then we're going to get back to what's coming up on Sunday. Stefan in Syracuse next. Go ahead, Stefan.
Hey, Evan, thanks. I just wanted to ask you in particular, because your son is really interested in baseball, as someone born in 1992 and didn't have a chance to experience some of those older, more nuanced, quirky parks, I'm experiencing that through playing video games, and I realize that the tactics and, you know, just kind of how the whole approach to even a single at bat with no one on base kind of turns on its head when you're playing at Sportsman's Park or something like that. So I was just curious if you've experienced, you know, any of the older stadiums through the video games. And I just wanted to say, as someone from a town who just sold our baseball team, we were locally owned and we just sold it to the Mets. So I really appreciate that you guys are still locally owned, and that's awesome.
Yeah, Stefan, thank you. I'm not a video game aficionado, though it doesn't surprise me that video games will recreate stadiums of the past. And I think that's a phenomenal idea, because obviously video games are big with the younger set, and that's a great way to connect to history. And, you know, frankly, you know, Pete Weber, Kurt Smith, Scott Pitoniak, you should all be consultants on games like that. I think that's a great way. I mean, you know, Pete, is that a dream job, designing video games of the past stadiums for the modern set here?
After an experience I had last week playing a video game involving the Cincinnati Reds in a current roster while in Crosley Field, and going against the Atlanta Braves and watching Marcell Ozuna struggle up the left field incline, yes, it is a
It's the old story about Ernie Lombardi of the Reds at, yes, Crosley Field, who was a catcher, and he was playing left field, and he went up the terrace and he fell down. He said, they taught me how to go up the terrace. They just didn't tell me how to come down.
Very unfair. And it was kind of like what happened here at old Sulphur Dell in Nashville. And we had a great presentation by Buck O'Neill one day, and he said, to play right field in that ballpark, you had to have a lot of billy goat in you.
These quotes and stories that you're sharing, they're so good, I wonder if they're apocryphal, but I'm sure that they are journalistically sound. They're so good.
Can I make a comment?
Yes,
to
Naomi,
Stefan? The International League, in lieu of playing actual baseball on our own fields, had a video game season, several games, and played for the championship. It was a Twitch game, and I think Stefan will probably know what that means.
Switch, probably Switch. Was it Twitch or Switch?
No, it was Twitch. It is Twitch.
It's Twitch.
See, I don't know.
Twitch, MLB The Show.
Oh, boy.
And just you know, so you know the Red Wings actually won that championship.
Oh, there you go. Yes.
Naomi, Governor's Cup.
Remind us when the last championship the Red Wings won on physical earth, Naomi.
You know, it was the year we opened Frontier Field, 1997. The dream year.
And I was on the call on Empire Sports.
We're incredible.
We're due, by the way. I mean, I don't really believe in due, but we're due.
Yeah, I hope this wasn't the year.
No. It wasn't going to be 2020. I've already checked.
Okay. All right, good.
Jacob in Rochester, keep it tight. Go ahead, Jacob.
Yeah, hi. I have two comments. One was about the cost. I would think that the cost of Major League Baseball is another reason keeping young folks away. And then the other was, what about the friendly confines? What do you guys think about the friendly confines, the unique place?
Great question, Jacob. Wrigley Field, I assume the friendly confines is Wrigley Field. And not only is Jacob wondering what our panel thinks about that, but we had a guest, we had a listener also write in to say that she thinks baseball made a mistake by putting too many games at night and liked the old school day games. Let's go down the panel here. Scott Pitoniak, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would prefer day baseball anytime, but it's the reality of it is that people are working and television rules everything. So they want the games in prime time, so they want night games. But yeah, I love day baseball. There's nothing like it, but it's just like World Series games in the daytime. We're probably not going to see them because baseball's ruled. Major League, I'm talking about Major League Baseball, is ruled by the almighty dollar and maximizing profits, and so we're not going to see it.
Okay, Kurt.
Wrigley is a magnificent place, but TV does rule. I should also add Forbes Field to the list of wonderful ballparks. Probably the most scenic ballpark in the history of the game.
The most scenic? The single most scenic? Wow.
The Ivy, the to its proximity next to the Cathedral of Learning, and Schenley Park in suburban Pittsburgh, a spectacular park.
What do you think, Pete?
Well, I got to tell you, as a Cardinals fan, I really appreciate Wrigley Field because they gave me Lou Brock on June 15th, 1964.
You should.
And helped us on to three pennants.
Naomi, day baseball or night baseball? What do you like better?
Well, you know, we try to play a day game during the week during every homestand, so we understand what it means to play during the day. You know, I guess I just wish that the League Championship Series and the World Series were certainly played earlier at night.
Yes.
It's hard to watch the end of a game at midnight. You know, you've got to use your DVR oftentimes, and I'd rather watch it live.
Yeah, and that has been a complaint that parents and kids have had as far back as I can remember, and I'm sure there's people smarter than me who run the books and the money and negotiate. And
I'm not sure.
I don't know, but they have figured that it's better. I think what we are seeing, though, is when you sow the seeds of ignoring the young fans, especially in the most important weeks of your season in the playoffs, then don't be surprised years later when they are adults and they're not taking their kids to games. And there's a real risk there, yeah.
I remember talking to Mel Allen. Your listeners will recognize the name, many of them, because he was the most recognizable voice for a quarter century in upstate New York, as voice of the Yankees. And 30 years ago, he was talking about this. He was then the voice of This Week in Baseball. And he was prophesying that baseball would pay a price among youngsters, because he said you can't fall in love with the game if you can't see the game. And I think, as you suggest, we're seeing the seeds now.
Well, I hope our listeners will, if they're really missing baseball and want a great Father's Day activity, 1 p.m. on Sunday afternoon, WXXI-TV is airing Last at Bat, and it is the rebroadcast of the final regular season home game at Silver Stadium in 1996. Naomi Silver, what do you remember most about that day?
Oh, gosh, it was so fraught with emotion. You know, we were very sentimental about leaving the old stadium, but so looking forward to, you know, the idea that baseball could continue for the foreseeable future, which, you know, we didn't feel that Silver Stadium was going to be able to accomplish that. So, It was a wonderful night. I'll tell you, that broadcast was so fantastic. And these guys, Pete and Kurt, were so, they were brilliant in that game and just so much fun to listen to. It was just a great night. And I can't wait to watch it on Sunday.
Pete, what do you remember
Naomi,
most?
Naomi, thank you.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah, Pete, what are your recollections of that night?
Well, number one, it was very emotional for me at that point, too. That was the place where I proposed to my wife, Claudia. And it was not at that game. It was several years prior to that. But so it was a very important place for us. And seeing all the greats come out and taking a look at the video here just a little bit, I hope everybody who has at least a DVR gets it programmed for Sunday afternoon. There can't be any better way, I don't think, to celebrate Father's Day than that, because that is what we've been talking about for the bulk of this hour, the traditions of the game getting handed down, and it's particularly in Rochester.
Well, and you're going to have listeners, if you watch on Sunday afternoon, you're going to have Pete Weber's voice that if you put Pete Weber's voice in a bottle and poured it on pancakes, it would be just fine. And then you've got Kurt Smith, who's apparently just an encyclopedia who needs to consult no notes. Everything just comes to... I mean, Kurt, the stories you're sharing in that broadcast, well, they're just like the Kurt Smith that I've grown to know over the years. What do you remember most about that night?
Well, I remember, first of all, that this is where I saw my first baseball game. My dad took me there in 1961, which was Boo Powell's first and only year in Rochester. And he became my late dad's favorite ball player, largely because of that. And he was a great Orioles fan. I, of course, became a Red Sox fan. I remember from that game an interview with Harry the Hat Walker. We talked at length about the classic 1946 World Series. Watching the game now, I remember how young I was. I also remember Pete, of course, hasn't aged a day. I remember also from that, and as I do now, what a seamless institution the Red Wings are. And, of course, the Silver family is so responsible for that in large measure and so beloved. I mean, of all the institutions in Rochester, the Red Wings, to me, are, and I know this phrase because my mother was a Latin teacher, but they're primus inter pares, first among equals. And that hasn't changed a bit. And that makes this broadcast very emotional to me. And of course, working with Pete, he won't mention this, but I will. Last year, he became the 7-time Tennessee Sportscaster of the Year. So, watching this broadcast, you can see why. So Tennessee's gain is our loss, but we're happy for him. So that's what I remember.
Well, and, you know, Kurt, you were younger, I mean, in 1996. I'll tell you what, watching that broadcast, I thought, oh, Dan Mason's son was working at the time.
Dan Mason. A word about Dan Mason. He is astonishing.
He is.
Talk about your Renaissance man.
He is.
In terms of what he does for this. And also, if I may, a word about Bob Matthews.
Mm-hmm.
Frontier Field doesn't happen without him. Likely doesn't happen. And I think we ought not to forget that as well.
Hmm. You're right. Both counts.
Scott Pitoniak, some final recollections from you on that transitional evening there.
Well, I would agree with Naomi. Like, I actually rewatched the broadcast last night, and Pete and Kurt were fabulous. And I thought the production quality was incredible, too. Like, you know, the shots of the fans, the different angles of the ballpark. You know, I was expecting some grainy old thing because we've been sheltering in place and seeing all these things like that. But this was a first class, really high quality production all the way through. But as far as that night, you know, I was there as a civilian. I had broken my leg in 7 places, so I was watching it on crutches from the old party deck out there. And I just remember the incredible emotions I was feeling. I thought the Wings did just an extraordinary job of saying goodbye to an old friend, and that's really how I felt. And I felt that way, you know, about some other ballparks. I was there for Cleveland, covering that when that was closed, and Yankee Stadium. And you know, we developed these emotional attachments to places, and I certainly had developed that from a love of history and research of history of the Rochester Red Wings for Silver Stadium.
1 p.m. Sunday afternoon, last at bat. Pete and Kurt leading the broadcast. It's the final game at Silver Stadium, but as Scott mentions there, and I think that's a great way to end this conversation, you know, it wasn't just a structure, a stadium on Norton Street. For thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people over the years, that was a place that felt like home. It was a place that felt like a summer home for them and their kids, and that was an important evening. And no surprise that they stuck the landing beautifully. And Naomi, let me just close by saying good luck to you and the Rochester Red Wings. I'm a journalist. I look forward to asking you a lot harder questions in the future, but for now I'm a fan, and we're all hoping to see baseball at some point.
Thank you so much.
Naomi Silver, the president and CEO of the Rochester Red Wings, and I'm looking at Frontier Field right now from this studio, and we can envision it being filled up again soon. Scott Pitoniak, always nice to have you, sir. Thanks for making time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kurt Smith, author, media host, columnist, Oracle. Thank you, Kurt. Always good.
Kevin, thank you. You bet.
And Pete Weber, one of the great broadcasters. Thanks for your recollections as well, Pete.
Thank you so much. May I reach for the Kleenex now? Thank you.
Yeah, I hear you. Short break, more connections coming up.